the death of cancer, and ultimately ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, Lyme disease, and long COVID. This is a wrenching, disturbing blog. It's putatively about cancer, but really, it's about medicine. To jump ahead a bit, the story does end well. But on the way to ending well, we get a good look at the underbelly of what goes on in the medical research and treatment fields at major institutions like the National Institutes of Health and major treatment centers. The sausage making is not pretty, but it can tell us a lot about how the medical profession can get stuck in ruts in even as dangerous diseases as cancer, as well as how it tends to dig itself out of them. The blog is on a book called The Death of Cancer by Vincent DeVita, a former leader of the National Cancer Institute, the chief physician at the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. There, from the beginning of the federal fight against cancer, DeVita has seen it all, and he doesn't pull any punches. In fact, he was encouraged by his colleagues not to write this book. The public, his colleagues said, don't need to know. Well, DeVita thought it did, and it's a shocker. The book is instructive for diseases like ME/CFS, FM, post-treatment Lyme disease, and long COVID, because cancer as a field of study, particularly the chemotherapeutic part of it, which DeVita played a prominent role in, had to battle against hidebound beliefs and outdated treatment approaches. DeVita showed, though, that however bad things got, that the curve ultimately did bend upwards. Even in that most dreaded of diseases, where making a mistake meant death for the patients, there was plenty of pettiness to go around. The book is a good lesson for anyone interested in how medical research and treatment works. In the foreword, DeVita cited something James Watson wrote. Science seldom proceeds in the straightforward logical manner imagined by outsiders. Instead, its steps forward, and sometimes backward, are often very human events in which personalities and cultural traditions play major roles. As we'll see, personalities and traditions will play a huge role in the fight against cancer. The Death of Cancer by Vincent DeVita. DeVita got involved in cancer in 1963, when the only options were surgery and radiotherapy. Things weren't going so well. It was a brutal time to have cancer. The most prominent treatment for breast cancer, called the Halstead procedure, removed the breast, the lymph nodes associated with it, and all the muscles covering the chest wall. Head and neck cancer surgeons would at times remove neck muscles, the jawbone, and even the tongue, at times leaving patients horribly disfigured. Cervical cancer could call for the removal of a woman's entire pelvis, leaving her with a permanent colostomy bag. Radiotherapy, the use of radiation to kill cancer cells, went a similar route as doctors prescribed heavier and wider toxic radiation treatments in attempts to cure their patients. In the end, the surgeons and radiotherapists had it backwards. The problem wasn't that the cancer had spread to the surrounding tissues. The problem was that as soon as it left its original site, it was traveling through the lymph nodes and blood and getting let loose in the body. Those big extensive surgeries weren't doing any good. That realization led to the development of chemotherapy, which used chemicals to track down and eliminate those cells. Chemotherapy was particularly rough in those days, but without chemotherapy, even cancer patients who had been successfully operated on or had radiotherapy were doomed. Their cancer was destined to reappear in another organ. The ever-present possibility of a cancer reoccurrence made the idea of a complete remission anathema in the field. MOPP gets whacked. Skip forward to the young oncologist named Vincent DeVita, trembling with excitement as he presented the first evidence that a new combination chemotherapy protocol called MOPP was producing complete remissions in Hodgkin's cancer patients. DeVita's excitement quickly waned, though, because he was attacked by Karnofsky, a leader in the oncology field, because, in quote, complete remissions were impossible. Once the alpha male, Karnofsky, got on DeVita's cases, the pack followed suit. A potentially major breakthrough in the cancer field was ignored, and the conference went on without a beat. DeVita and colleagues put their heads down and pumped out another study. 4 years later, he returned to announce that the new protocol had produced complete remissions in 80% of the patients. DeVita was told again and again, though, that his protocol didn't work. He found out why when he gave a talk at one of the preeminent cancer centers of the day, Memorial Sloan Kettering. Told by leading oncologists of the day that his data must be wrong, DeVita questioned them. In a remarkable case of institutional arrogance, it turned out that the mighty oncologists at Sloan Kettering weren't using his carefully worked out protocol at all. They'd decided they knew better. They'd substituted drugs which had originated at Sloan Kettering for parts of his protocol. They had cut the dose of one drug in half because it made their patients nauseous, and changed the timing of the drugs given. The same thing happened at Stanford, where instead of using body size to determine the dose of a toxic drug called vincristine, as the protocol called for, doctors simply capped the dose at 2 milligrams. DeVita saw this happen so many times, he began to wonder how many oncologists were actually reading the paper. Workwell got a similar response when they published results of their two-day exercise tests in ME-CFS. Your data, they were told by exercise physiologists, must be wrong. The good news is that the cancer field ultimately did come around, and Hodgkin's lymphoma is considered one of the most treatable of all cancers now. The MOPP protocol developed by DeVita and colleagues is no longer the standard of care, but is still used in some cases. Even in severe cases, the 5-year survival rate of Hodgkin's lymphoma is 85%. Adjuvant chemotherapy gets the cold shoulder in the U.S. The next step was something called adjuvant chemotherapy, which involved treating patients who appeared to be free of cancer with chemotherapy. Adjuvant chemotherapy was appealing because patients who appeared to be free of cancer after surgery or radiation often came down with cancer later and died. DeVita ran into a wall again, though, when he tried to recruit patients for their trials. The major cancer centers, which were dominated by surgeons, refused to participate in trials. Never mind that many of their patients would later die of the cancer. They appeared to be cancer-free at the time. Unable to get the study done in the U.S., DeVita had to go to Europe to get it done. It worked, and adjuvant chemotherapy and other adjuvant treatments are now considered standard care for many cancers. Bernie Fisher's bad news. Even the medical journals got involved in the turf battles. DeVita recalled how a study by a pioneering cancer researcher named Bernie Fisher got hung up in the New England Journal of Medicine for almost a year. The study examined the difference in the outcomes for mastectomy, often the full removal of the breast, and lumpectomy, the removal of the tumor and the area around it. The study was an uphill battle from the beginning. As with the adjuvant chemotherapy study, it had difficulty getting off the ground because it had trouble finding surgeons who would participate. By the time the study got done its findings, no difference in survival rates between lumpectomies and mastectomies meant that many women could be spared the total removal of their breast, their lymph nodes, and their chest muscles. That might have been good news for women, but it was not for the surgeons who dominated the cancer field. the study had been sent out to two big name surgeons who unilaterally rejected it, causing it to be sent out to other surgeons for review. The holdup lasted so long that DaVita published the findings in the NCI's clinical alerts section to get them out as quickly as possible before the study was published. When the study was finally published years later, it changed how breast cancer surgery was done. DaVita blamed economics for the holdup. The arguments against the approach, we've been doing it this way for 75 years and it needs more study, were so specious that DaVita believed money had to be behind it. Surgeons made 90% of their money from doing extensive breast surgeries and didn't want that to stop. When it became clear that radiation therapy wasn't always warranted, radiotherapists revolted and began to refuse to cooperate in large studies unless radiation therapy, whether it was needed or not, was included. Fisher was ultimately called a medical hero and an iconoclastic figure who brought about, quote, far-reaching changes in the understanding of cancer and its treatment, end quote. He was awarded the Albert Lasker Award for Clinical Medical Research in 1985, quote, for his pioneering studies that have led to a dramatic improvement in survival and in the quality of life for women with breast cancer, end quote. Personalities matter. Mary Lasker and the National Cancer Act of 1971. Personalities matter. Strong personalities like DaVita, DaVita's mentor Emil Freireich, and Mary Lasker survived vicious attacks from within the medical field, but ultimately prevailed. Freireich, the originator of the combination chemotherapy approach that is now standard in the field, was chastised, ridiculed, questioned on the veracity of his publications, and called a murderer. DaVita recalled that his associates had been warned by the professors not to get too close to Freireich, who felt that the NCI was a good place to go to stay out of Vietnam, but stay away from Freireich. Freireich came close to being fired 3 times while at the National Cancer Institute, but survived because he had the support of upper management. He went on to become one of the seminal leaders of the field. Mary Lasker was the wife of Albert Lasker, an advertising executive whose firm ironically wrote ads, "Lucky Strike means fine tobacco," promoting smoking for women. Together they created the Lasker Foundation in 1942 and the Lasker Award, which over time became second only to the Nobel Prize in prestige. After the Laskers failed to get Eisenhower's National Health Insurance Bill passed, they focused on research and transformed the sleepy American Society for the Control of Cancer into American Cancer City. They played a major role in vastly increasing funding for the National Institutes of Health, but Mary Lasker's major focus, though, was in cancer, where she was the brainchild of the National Cancer Act of 1971. Ironically, she wanted to get the National Cancer Institute as far away from the NIH as possible. Lasker believed the NIH was too focused on basic research and not enough on research that benefited patients. To that end, Lasker was able, in the end, to get the NCI as isolated as possible. Today, the NCI is funded not from within the NIH, but by congressional appropriations. The NCI's leader is appointed by the president, not the NIH. The NCI runs its own clinical trials, funds over 70 cancer centers, has a physician training program, and besides doing basic research, awards contracts, which it gives to companies to provide specific results. One area Lasker failed, though, was to get the NCI to create cancer centers outside of the university setting. Lasker believed the universities were too focused on producing basic research and shied away from the clinical research that directly helped patients. She turned out to be right. Turf battles at the National Cancer Institute. The early iterations of the National Cancer Institute where DaVita and colleagues had made their discoveries, were a mess. The so-called division of cancer treatment only included chemotherapy. The two other main approaches to cancer treatment, surgery and radiation, were in other departments, and they wanted it to stay that way. Despite the fact that it was becoming clear that no one approach worked best and that treatments worked best when used together, DaVita describes departments more focused on defending their own turf than on producing the best patient care. With each department running their own trials, it was impossible to coordinate research and find the best approach for patients. Patients with cancer tended to get surgery, radiation, or chemotherapy depending on which doctor they saw. Most only got one choice, but when more were added, the lack of studies on multiple therapies meant that patients often got huge doses of each, leading to sometimes awful outcomes. To add more mischief, two national clinical trial groups were outside the entire process and were doing, in DaVita's words, boring, repetitive, and wasteful clinical studies. DaVita was asked to take over the Division of Cancer Treatment and agreed to if all the cancer treatment efforts were put underneath one roof. In 1980, he became the National Cancer Institute's director and remained there for 8 years, where he instituted various reforms. During that time, DaVita brought an empirical approach to cancer, which emphasized patient health. To that end, he brought in a public specialist called Peter Greenwald, MD, who later stated, "We need to change the whole climate, the whole staff." Cancer prevention, for instance, became a focus for the first time, and the NCI actively engaged in efforts to reduce smoking and improve diets. The not-so Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. In 1988, DaVita became physician-in-chief and attending physician at one of the oldest and probably the most famous cancer centers in the world, the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. People came from all over the world to be treated at the famous MSKCC, but too often, DaVita asserted, they got substandard treatment. Instead of using its immense endowment to creatively explore new approaches to cancer, the MSKCC had become sclerotic as the old guard running it reflexively rejected new approaches. Despite the fact that it was clear by 1988 that lumpectomies were now considered the standard of care for women with small tumors, every woman with breast cancer at the MSKC received a radical mastectomy. Because MSKCC didn't believe in adjuvant or post-surgical chemotherapy, nobody got that either, with the inevitable result that some women's cancer would return in a different organ and they would likely die. Nor were patients likely to get radiotherapy. The most prominent cancer center in the world had gone all in on surgery, when it was clear to most of the rest of the world that combination therapies were the most effective. DaVita recalled a presentation at MSKC where Bernie Fisher was screamed at by a surgeon who was advocating super radical mastectomies and called, quote, "a traitor to his profession," end quote. If a drug or treatment protocol hadn't been developed at the MSKC, it was automatically suspect. And if an MSKCC drug or protocol was available, it was used. The huge research department was isolated from the clinical wing, with the result that while a lot of basic research was being done, little of it had application to the patients. Plus, the patient facilities were run down. The radiotherapy department was using out-of-date machines, and a crumbling and out-of-date administration was inefficient, leading to long lines of sick patients waiting for their care. DaVita began by bringing in new leadership and instituting grand rounds of conferences that brought leading cancer researchers to the hospital to speak. 8 years later, after clashing with the president of the MSKCC, he was out and headed to Yale to become the dean of the Yale School of Medicine. He left behind, however, a strategic plan that would ultimately serve the MSKCC well. Yale gets its lifeline and more. DeVita found that Lasker had been right to distrust academia. The universities and the NCI's cancer centers were almost wholly centered on basic research. Yale, which contained one of the NCI's cancer centers, was floundering and was in danger of losing, for the second time, its designation and the funding that came with it as an NCI cancer center. DeVita reported that he was stunned at what he found. 20 years after becoming a national cancer center, Yale didn't even have a physical building devoted to cancer care. Nothing, he said, was going on. Focused research was a joke, and its clinical trials program was housed in a closet. Things were in such disarray that a breast cancer patient who had a biopsy would have a needle put in her chest and then wheeled 3 blocks to the building where the biopsy took place. No signs directed patients to the cancer center existed because there was no cancer center. Part of the problem is the tenure system at universities. In order to earn tenure, researchers are expected to turn out dozens of research papers. But because clinical trials take years to complete and get published, budding professors stay away from them. Before he left the NCI, DeVita had spent 6 years driving through stricter guidelines for the cancer centers that required viable clinical trials programs, greater authority of the directors with regard to research, clinical trials, etc. In effect, the goal was to get the centers out from under the university's thumb and back to their original mission to help patients. Yale was the first center to be assessed under the new guidelines. DeVita made it clear that it did not pass muster, but with the former head of the NCI in charge, Yale was given a lifeline. DeVita called getting an actual clinical center built at Yale maddening. The hospital didn't want anything to do with research, and the university didn't want anything to do with clinical care. It wasn't just Yale. These problems permeate the NCI's cancer centers at academic institutions across the country. Hope. It's been a pretty grim story so far, but by the end of the book, DeVita has some good news. Despite all the problems, the trend has been steadily upward. After a slow start, the NCI's cancer centers have improved. 10 years after he left, Kettering Sloan had acted on all 10 items of the strategic plan he'd left behind, and he now considered it an excellent center. Yale now has a physical cancer center and is actively integrating its cancer research and clinical programs. At the time this book was written, DeVita stated that the Memorial Sloan Kettering once again had world-class breast, pediatric, urologic, and neurological cancer programs, but still lagged behind in lymphomas. Yale was best in class at treating cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, but was behind the times in urologic cancers. The Mayo Clinic was great at treating common tumors, but he would never send a difficult case there. NYU's Perlmutter Center is an ace at brain tumors, but not much else. The list goes on. For adult leukemia, go to MD Anderson in Houston. For myeloma, check out Dean Farber. For difficult cases of breast cancer, the University of Pittsburgh was the best place to be. How effective a center is at treating a kind of cancer depends on its resources, its staffing, and its organizational capabilities. DeVita said that the PDQ, Physician Data Query, can help patients find the best centers for their cancers. It's rarely needed, though, as the vast majority of cancers are perfectly well treated at community hospitals. It's only the 15% of cancer patients who have particularly difficult cancers who could be helped by specialists at these big centers. Cancer, of course, is still a major killer, but 5-year cancer survival rates are up to 50% since DaVita began his work, and overall mortality rates are declining by a remarkable 2% a year. The $100 billion or so that's gone into cancer research has more than paid its way economically. DaVita sees the day when most cancers will be considered chronic diseases, which are simply managed over time. Chronic myeloid leukemia, for instance, was a death sentence in the 1970s, but is now being fully managed simply by taking a pill every day. The tumor is not gone, it's simply no longer growing, and the patient effectively has a chronic disease. Some cancers will be managed with long-term low doses of easily manageable chemotherapy. Targeted chemotherapy treatments based on the genetic makeup of the tumor are increasing survival rates. Vitamin A derivatives plus standard cancer protocols have turned acute leukemia, formerly a death sentence, into a 70% curable one. Even the dreaded melanoma is susceptible to treatment in many cases. ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, post-treatment Lyme disease, and long COVID. What would DaVita's saga through the upper reaches of our medical system mean for us? Cancer is a big deal, after all, and the National Cancer Institute at the NIH gets plenty of funding, $7.2 billion. ME/CFS, FM, and most post-viral diseases get a fraction of that and are still struggling to break into the medical mainstream. Cancer was not such a big deal, though, when DaVita started out. In fact, cancer had a reputation similar to that found in ME/CFS today. It was considered unbeatable, a black hole for research. Propelled by figures like Mary Lasker, once cancer did receive funding, progress was steadily made. With the many different cancers present, and the different and sometimes competing treatment options and cliques that formed around them, building a more efficient field and uncovering the best practices of care was a challenge. At each step of the road, pioneering figures like Emil Freireich, Bernie Fischer, and Vincent DaVita faced steep challenges from the old guard, the purveyors of received wisdom, and from doctors and researchers who cared more about their incomes than their patients' lives. The good news is that despite the horror stories, the pioneers won out in the end, and the barriers that so hobbled the field in the beginning have mostly been overcome. While the field is continuing to evolve, it's in better shape than ever. ME/CFS, FM, and post-viral diseases are not in such a different case as cancer was in the 1960s. If Ron Davis is right, the problem is not so much that these diseases are disbelieved, but more that they are perceived as a kind of impenetrable problem. These fields face the same resistance from the old guard that the pioneering cancer researchers once did. Despite the challenges, no matter how slowly it does so, the curve has always bent upwards towards more effective technologies, more effective research, and more effective organizations. Plus, we have something we've never had before, unity and the numbers. ME/CFS, fibromyalgia, post-treatment Lyme disease, post-viral and long COVID disease advocates now recognize that we must band together, that these diseases must be studied together, and that they must get more funding. The RECOVER initiative, as many problems as it seems to have, is an example of a different era we are in. RECOVER received $1.15 billion and then another $500 million recently to study a post-infectious disease. It should not be missed how important congressional action was in the NCI's emergence as a major institute and in long COVID. The RECOVER initiative may be in trouble, but so was the National Cancer Institute and its cancer centers at their inception. Strong personalities and leaders in the field that were determined to produce change played invaluable roles. if the curve truly does bend upwards, then the problems will get worked out. The proposed NIH Post-Infectious Disease Center is essentially seeking to replicate what DaVita did at the NCI and create a comprehensive and effective effort to study these diseases. That takes replacing silos with connections, and some of this is happening outside the NIH. Pioneers in the field, like David Petrino at Mount Sinai, are building a comprehensive post-viral disease center. Grants are popping up to study not just PTLDS, but PTLDS in combination with diseases like ME/CFS. The curve is bending upwards. The only question is how much time it will take to produce the results we want.